And sorry to correct you, Mike. It's a turbo lift.
Oh, well, or lift. In the turbo lift.
Yeah, it's not an elevator. I mean, it looks...
Does the same thing, but we know it's a turbo lift.
It was the dawn of a new season of You've Got to Check This Out, 10 weeks after the Nerd Youngblood episode. The Babylon 5 television show was a dream given form, its goal to tell a five-year story arc and prove the audience would follow along peacefully. It's a major accomplishment, a seminal work, a nostalgic property for nerds, geeks, children of the 80s, and our hosts. This season, we'll dive deep into Babylon 5 Season 1. The year is 2025, and you've got to check this out.
Welcome to Nerd. I think we're calling this You Gotta Check This Out. I'm Dre Alvarez, founder of Places Nerd Numbers, and I have with me an awesome co-host.
I'm Mike Slater, coming to you from, well, from Evanston and from the last Youngblood episode of Nerd.
Yeah, you showed up on Youngblood. We started chatting Babylon 5 in the comments with each other, and we decided, hey, Nerd is a lot of fun. So for those that don't know, if you are here at the patreon.com/JeffMay, that's the intro point. If you're finding us at the Jeff Has Cool Friends feed, this is an offshoot of the Nerd Show, which myself and Jeff May do. We wanted to do more, and Jeff's comment is, I am but one man. You can do more Nerd, but he can't be involved. And Mike, you had such a great idea as a start. You were like, let's talk Babylon 5.
Yeah, see, that's what we have on Jeff, is we are actually two people. So, you know, it really works out along those lines.
Yeah, it works perfectly. We're the X-Men Blue versus X-Men Gold, or X-Men Gold versus X-Men Blue. Take your pick. So the premise of the show that we're banding about, and we're going to do at least the first season on Babylon 5, keeping with the nerd theme, trilogies. We're doing You Gotta Check This Out. So the premise is, we're going to introduce something to you. And the reason we got this up is Jeff has never seen Babylon 5. It's one of my favorites, one of your favorites. And so the premise we're coming in with is, we're going to show you something. We're going to say, you got to check this out. It might be spoiler heavy. It might have a lot of lore, but we're going to do like an individual episode. For Babylon 5, we are going to do 3 to 4 episodes. If you're hearing this, this is bonus content. This is either our unaired pilot, very much like Babylon 5, The Gathering, or bonus content if we love it enough. You know, spoiler, Mike, I think we're going to love it enough. We're going to release this at some point.
This, we have a lot of material for this already, thinking of it as an episode zero of sorts. So we'll see what happens here. But yeah, I'm excited to dive into this one.
Well, you know what's actually really cool, Mike, when we talk about this? So again, the theme is Babylon 5. We're talking season one of Babylon 5. We are going to be bringing you 3 to 4 jam-packed episodes. Now, our pilot episode that we're recording first but may show up last is episode 4, Infection. So if for whatever reason you don't want anything spoiled, you can go Babylon 5. It's streaming online. I think Amazon. I know Jeff doesn't like that. The DVDs are super cheap. Some libraries even have the DVDs. The entire Blu-ray set just came out. So if you, there are ways to watch this episode if you would like. This is episode 1, Infection. I don't want to sound too mean, Mike. I don't think you're missing anything if you miss the first 3 episodes. There's some stuff that happens we can talk, but if you just watch.
I think we got to go into that a little bit too, because part of our reason for wanting to start this show is to be able to share topics that we really enjoy and want to go a little bit deeper than you go on the regular Nerd episodes.
But then also, like, the thing being, like, we don't want to say to you, as Jeff might do on a normal Nerd episode, okay, watch all of Babylon 5 Season 1 before we talk this.
Yeah.
What we do want to say is, like, in theory, if you were a co-host on the show or a listener to the show, you could just watch Infection on its own. We'll give you some background first if you want to listen to that first before you watch the episode. Then we can talk about the episode. And if we do spoilers, we'll give you spoiler warnings. And Mike, I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but you're an amazing musician. At some point, I think if we're going to do spoilers, we can definitely have some good like cue in music for that.
Oh yeah, we'll get plenty of cues on this. I mean, if any segments develop out of the show, we'll get some segment talks, but yeah. As far as Babylon 5 goes, do we want to give a little precursor to the show before? Because we're not starting with the first episode of Babylon 5.
And that's actually what I was going to say. It's cool. We're starting with episode 4, Infection, which, as you noted to me before the show, was actually the first episode that J. Michael Straczynski wrote. We'll go into that. We'll do one really quick thing just in case. Mike Slater, we can find you at mikeslater.com. Any handles you want online for people to look for you as well?
Usually find me everywhere at Slatetron or Slatetron 11 if I didn't get the original handle. But yeah, Slatetron 11 at Blue Sky is the best way to get a hold of me. That's the one I look at the most.
Wow, you were slow on Blue Sky. That's Greenfield. That's like the one where we're getting the new ones. But so Slatetron, that's S-L-A-T-R-O-N, or put an 11 at the end in some cases, such as Blue Sky. Blue Sky is where a lot of people are starting to go. So hopefully it takes off. If it all crashes, I think I'm just out of energy.
Yeah, you'll find me where all the handles are at, some Slatetron at all. But yeah, Blue Sky is what I'm paying attention to. How about you, Dre? Where are you at most these days?
And then MikeSlater.com again. And then I'm Nerd Numbers most places. Nerd Numbers on chess.com, Nerd Numbers on Blue Sky, Nerd Numbers on sites that I no longer post on anymore, but did back in the day. And yeah, let's give some background on Babylon 5. And this episode is really emblematic of a lot of stuff. So I'm going to toss the ball to you. Let's see if what you want to say. We're within mind, we're talking Babylon 5, season one.
Yeah, we were looking at a bunch of episodes to start with this one up. And this one made sense because as we're both watching Babylon 5, me, it turns out this is the first time I've watched the series all the way through. I had an early exposure to Babylon 5 when it was first on at about the third or fourth season in the mid-90s, where a roommate of mine was really into it. And he was one of these guys that was just handing me printouts from the Lurker's Guide online, trying to get me into the show. It was college. I would watch a few episodes with him once in a while, and he would just fill me in on all the back episodes as I went. But my memory over time told me that I had seen the whole series. During this episode, everything is kind of new to me. I'm really enjoying it as the first time through. So you're going to, throughout this whole season, I think you're going to be acting more as the guide to these episodes, knowing what's to come.
Yeah.
And now Dre explains.
Babylon 5, for those that may have missed it, was a science fiction show that came out in the early 90s, heralded by J. Michael Straczynski, who came with an ambitious plan. He had a five-year arc from the get-go. He pitched this to multiple places, including Star Trek. Now, funny story. Many people know this, but if you don't, Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, is based on the Bible for this show. J. Michael Straczynski, prolific writer, had written on He-Man, the Real Ghostbusters television show, was a co-creator of She-Ra, multitude of other things.
Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, Murder, She Wrote as well. A multitude of other things in Hollywood. Eventually, like, the thing that really probably strikes big is he wrote for the comic book Thor. And then, of course, some of his storylines were actually used in the movie Thor. He shows up very briefly in Thor.
Yeah, and he's the guy that's movie picking up the hammer the first time when they find the desert.
On the Nerd Show with Dre and Jeff, we have discussed various comic series, including Spider-Man and JMS. Like, we could do a whole episode on JMS himself, which would be awesome.
Tell it like it is, Dre.
Prolific writer comes up with a sci-fi show, and the premise is a space station, kind of a model UN, really building on League of Nations, World War I, World War II history for a lot of his storyline. But aliens on a space station, League of Nations, Star Trek vibe, but a five-year arc, which going in and saying, I have a five-year idea, and people going, you don't know if you're going to last a season, was ambitious. And the wild success I'll give him is he did this with two shows, Babylon 5 and Deep Space Nine, now both heralded as fantastic science fiction television, and both managed to have gigantic arcs.
Yeah, and the big difference is, so Deep Space Nine was still more of an episodic regular series at the time. You just touched on it, but Babylon 5's big claim to fame is he had the entire five-year arc planned from the beginning and wanted to be played out as a novel, where each episode was a chapter in the novel that would play out over time. And there was so many problems with it because all shows had to be formulaic. They had to get to a certain point where you could get to syndication, and there was no guarantee of what order they would be broadcast in. So any story would be jumbled out of order by the time it got syndication. Actors, how could you have an actor have a major arc that would change over five seasons if you're not even guaranteed if their contract or something in their life is going to take them out of the show for a while? So he was able to be really part of the first show that juggled all of these elements and made a successful five season arc story.
So there are two nice comparables that I'm going to bring up, Mike. So the first, by the way, is it really reminds me of Avatar Legend of Korra, where similar idea, every season JMS wanted, as you're saying, like a chapter. So it's a five-year arc, but every year is its own complete storyline. And he basically has it. He does actually do it as a year. So we start at the beginning of the year. The end of season one ends at the end of Earth year, what, 2250? One of the 2250s. So he ends at the end of the year. And he keeps
I can never get the year, the future year straight. Like they, I'm reading all the wikis and it always presents like 2253. 23 even happens 100 years ago. I don't know how they expect us to keep all of these timelines straight.
Well, that's the thing. You can open up the Wikipedia. There is, as you already noted, another thing that was monumental about the show at the time is it was one of the first shows that had a huge internet following because it was, you know, early days of the internet. And J. Michael Straczynski was just actually really involved.
Somebody saved the entire archives of, it's not on the Wayback Machine, of the Lurkers guy, the original Usenet group that was actually started before the pilot even aired. People had already had word of what he was doing and were already starting to compile a big world-building Usenet archive, which if you look up the Lurkers guide, you can find out like remnants of it still out there.
And that is jmsnews.com is the site. So that's even cool. You don't even have to go to archive.com. So this giant, huge arc, just super ambitious thing to go in with for all these reasons. And I think what you noted is how to kind of sell that. And that's why this, that's why we settled on this first episode, which again, for the fifth or sixth time, is episode 4, Infection, from season 1. And while you and I were rewatching this, we did notice that JMS, I'm just going to call him JMS for the rest of the show, did this very bait and switch thing. He introduces this, it almost feels like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. The first couple of episodes are very monster of the week, traditional Star Trek episode. Here's our philosophical conundrum. He was a huge sci-fi fan, so writers like Harlan Ellison show up regularly as story consultants. Speaking of episodes, we're not going into the first three of Babylon 5. One of them is Soul Hunter, and it was an amazing concept that I feel was just almost burned, which is, what if the Grim Reaper was a serial killer? Was kind of what I would call the underlying story, and it's like a throwaway story for episode 2 in this series.
Yeah, but it's like, even that one was, I was considering bringing that one up for the full episode date, because that's the first one where, instead of just being a monster of the week, JMS was able to tie it into world building of the series, too, where it wasn't just trying to steal people's souls. It was trying to save people's souls at the end. And it was all about, if I remember, Delon the Mimbari holding a sacred place for their souls and have an actual meeting, which in that particular episode, it just seemed like some sci-fi mumbo jumbo. Okay, that's what they're doing. Their souls are represented by something. But as the series went on and on, we find out that those were actually seeds that were being planted for how important what the Mimbari soul and human souls would be down the line when it came to Sinclair, especially.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, because that's the key, is he's doing Monster of the Week to start off season one. So I had traditionally, in my remembering, had remembered season one as kind of weaker. There are a variety of reasons. I think any new show has growing pains. As a sci-fi show, they do fantastic with the makeup on the show.
Have you heard this one? Yeah, I got a great series for you to watch, but just skip over season one and two because it doesn't get cooking until the third one.
I would say, I don't even think, tell me if I'm wrong here. I don't think you need to skip it. Having rewatched it, it actually aged better than I thought. This is it's like a reverse He-Man or a reverse other shows where I had remembered season one as weaker. And part of the reason is, to give it a nice pitch, is just how strong seasons 2 through 4 are. I think seasons 2 through 4 of Babylon 5 are like three of the greatest years of television ever, a monumentous achievement. And season one is like gaining footing, and there is so much stuff going on. They're recording for the whole series, but you know, they're recording in a hot tub factory, basically a defunct hot tub factory. They're on a shoestring budget. The other metaphor, Mike, you said you don't like sports, is Moneyball. So if you don't know, hopefully some of you out there are nerdy enough to know this, but Moneyball is actually a really geeky sports story. It's about the Oakland Athletics, and the premise is this poor sports team, and that's kind of a myth, but we'll give it to you for storytelling purposes. This poor sports team, run by Billy Beane, played by Brad Pitt in the movie, is able to use numbers to fight against the monumentous teams.
Hey, like that's in
New
your
York
name.
Yankees and the Boston, I almost said Celtics, but the Boston Red Sox. Now, here's the funny reality at the end of that. And this happens in the movie, and this happened in real life. Yeah, he does use analytics. Yeah, they do win. And then the Red Sox and the Yankees go, oh, cool, we'll just pay for those. And the end of the movie ends with the Boston Red Sox hiring analytics people, and the Red Sox have gone on to be a dynasty.
Is this a Star Trek metaphor, Dre?
It's a Star Trek metaphor for Babylon 5, because Babylon 5, JMS's idea, JMS's baby. But guess what? When he was pitching the show, he pitched it to the Star Trek people, and there's lots of good stuff out there. There's even like a Secret Galaxy episode on this. He pitched it to Star Trek. Star Trek, we're nice. We're JMS fans on here. They stole it. They stole it. And he was told by his contacts at WB, who is the top brass that produced this on, I forget the network, it's now defunct, but they had their like own sci-fi network. They basically said, if you get in a legal battle, neither show gets made. So yep. It was almost a hell where it's going, J. Michael Straczynski had to put out what I would argue is probably a better written show, but with less money, less budget, less special effects, even though they did embrace CGI, than Star yep. Trek, with a competing show and people, and Star Trek came out first. So it's kind of going, he got to get called the imposter of the thing he made, because if he had sued them, nobody gets to make anything. And
Star Trek came out first, but it's important that Babylon 5, the pilot, came out before Deep Space Nine.
Oh, so the Gathering episode, which I watched, and I will say this, this probably has got to be right up your alley. The Gathering, which is the, I think, 2-hour pilot, made for TV movie intro. It's not good. I'm sorry. It's really not. And there, I'm going to get to use it in a future episode of this season of You Gotta Check This Out, but it's not good. But one of the major things it's missing is Christopher Frank. I hope I'm saying his name right, the composer. A huge part of this series is the music. The music is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so let's actually jump into the episode. And here's the good news. Like I said, we're super early. In my opinion, you could skip right to episode 4 and not have missed anything. And in fact, I think you can skip this episode if you're just kind of doing a cursory rewatch and fill in the blanks. We're going to get people caught up. And then in theory, we'll say, hey, if you want to go watch the episode and then come back and hear us, cool. Or if you just want to hear us do our beat by beat through it, cool as well. But anything they need to know going into this episode. And what I'll say is this episode does a lot, because it's so early, does do a lot of regurgitating of world building. So that we're going to discuss that. Basically, you could go into this episode as a new viewer, having missed the first 3 episodes and even the pilot. And I'm going to argue you don't miss that much.
Yeah. Up until you get to episode 9 of the first season, it really doesn't build on too much of anything before it, or really set too much up that if you miss it, you're not going to miss out later on when the big arc really starts coming up. Yeah. The first few episodes of this are all like, we keep referring to it as a Monster of the Week episode. It almost feels like a Buffy style Star Trek. They needed something to keep the series going. When you're starting a new series, let's say you have a huge five season arc planned out. How do you get people not only to appreciate that arc, but to stick around long enough to actually see what's going on? You don't have the seeds planted for the first handful of episodes. So what do you do in the meantime? You have to do a bunch of other plot items, a lot of other kind of cheap plot things to get along, to get people interested, which is where this Monster of the Week idea that we had keep coming back to. And what the other thing I noticed is, as the season goes by and by, we'll talk about this later, but they kind of get rid of the Monster of the Week. It's very apparent for the first 10 episodes where there is a central, just a hook that doesn't really leave a lot for the rest of the series. And then that slowly gives way to the style of storytelling we'll see in later seasons toward the end of season 1.
At this episode, too, that is huge. Let's get going. You can watch it with us. Click. You can either stop and go watch it yourself. We might be a better medium to watch it, Mike, not to sound mean. There's some good acting. There's some actors finding themselves. I'm a little bummed because Jerry Doyle, who plays Garibaldi, the fantastic chief of security, he is very much like Worf in more ways than one, right? He's the badass chief of security. But if you're going to have a badass chief of security on any of these shows, they intrinsically have to be bad at your job or the show doesn't happen, right? The monster doesn't sneak onto the space station if your chief of security is doing his job really well. But we also have to believe he's a badass. That's Jerry Doyle. And as he's fighting himself early, it doesn't happen in this episode, but in earlier episodes, he doesn't know what to do with his hands. You and I both commented multiple times. There are just episodes where he's doing the superstar thing and just has his hands in his armpits.
It's usually when he's in his Predator elevator. Did you notice that same elevator in the first couple episodes where he's like coming down with his arms in his pits, where he's usually hitting on Winters? It's always that same set.
And sorry to correct you, Mike. It's a turbo lift or a lift, right?
That's in the turbo lift.
Yeah, it's not an elevator. I mean, it looks
all right. It does the same thing, but we know it's a turbo lift.
So what I actually throw out here is this is kind of what we were talking about earlier episodes and impressiveness of world building, because Michael Garibaldi, the chief of security of the station, is meeting with an ISN reporter. She is played by Patricia Healy, who doesn't do much, but was the girlfriend on Heat. It is fun to look at all the guest actors and actresses on the show. Some go on to do monumentous things. Some have amazing back catalogs. Some are bit players. They're kind of all over the place.
I kept calling her Miss Piggy in this one because she seems to be styled exactly like Miss Piggy.
Oh my gosh, I did not see it. I mean, now, and for what it's worth, she is like a beautiful actress, but she's got like the frizzy hair. And she's to your point, very combative, intentionally so, because she's doing the "damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor" while screaming exposition at our regulars to tell, basically as a trick, to tell the audience stuff. Because this is ISN, that's the Interstellar News Network, going to be a huge part over the arc of the show. Lots of fun there. Doesn't really show up here, but she's on to interview the captain of the ship, Captain Sinclair. He's ducking her. She's talking to Garibaldi, the chief of security, and she's saying, "I can't believe the captain doesn't want to talk to me. This station has been around 2 years. Don't you realize what a big deal that is? This is Babylon 5. So for those that notice, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that implies it's the fifth, which is true. Turns out the first four Babylon stations, none of them went operational, with the exclusion of Babylon 4, which went missing 24 hours after going operational, which she tells us. Now, again, she's screaming it at Garibaldi, who already knows it. But it's key because she's a reporter coming in saying, "I'm trying to do a story. Don't you understand why I'm trying to do my story? Let me throw a lot of exposition at you as I do it."
This is, I mean, I didn't see too much direct exposition, especially the first time I watched this. It didn't move the plot of the episode forward. But what it did, like, as I watched it another couple times, it showed what people back Earth were thinking, too. Because this is JMS did a lot of these little kind of drops in that the Earth Force was definitely an anti-alien, pro-Earth faction that was slowly gaining power on Earth. And I think this is a good way to show it early on before we even got much the Santiago stuff or the plot later on, is that people on Earth are wary of alien species, and there is a jingoistic faction to Earth that is going to keep coming into play throughout the entire series.
When we talk about the season as a story chapter,
exposition.
The season starts with, as you're mentioning, an election. So President Santiago is elected president of Earth, and that's going to persist throughout the entire season. It doesn't show up too much in this episode, but a key thing is the Earth-Mimbari War, which is mentioned in the opening crawl with Michael O'Hare doing the read-over. This happens every season of Babylon 5. You have a main character reading the Babylon station that gives a bunch of stuff. And so the feedback here is, it was built as a place of peace 10 years after the Earth-Mimbari War.
Far out, man.
We don't get too much into the Earth-Mimbari War this episode, but as you're noting, yes, the Earth and the contentions with alien races trying to make them place in the stars. Well, the Babylon station is trying to be essentially a United Nations to hold everything together, is happening at the same time. And so what I wrote about this scene in particular is, world building, the Babylon 4, the Earth politics with aliens. And then what I kind of noted is, randomly in this scene, Patricia asks where the restroom is. And Garibaldi's like, "Over that way, don't go into the one for just the methane breathers." And in season one and the pilot, they try and play up more of the different alien species, different environments, not mixing. The pilot episode has a joke about you have to be on a list of alien species that are allowed for interspecies breeding. So you're not allowed to breed, which actually makes sense, but is kind of amusing. And they kind of use that throughout season one, but kind of drop it as the series progresses.
Oh, yeah, because that's just so difficult to keep up. That's the ball in the air that you don't have to keep going, especially once you've established that in the first few episodes, that this are the kind of things they're dealing with. We don't want to be dealing with the bureaucratic side of Babylon 5 forever.
And it is worth, I mean, the Star Trek, did they have the solution, right, where there's some ancient species? Yeah, we went all over the galaxy and planted these things, so you're all built from the same things. That's why you're all similar species. It's like, good, cheap.
So a few more things about this scene that really, I thought, illustrated the differences between Star Trek and Babylon 5. The biggest one that I've always seen is that Star Trek is a utopia. It's a the idea of what a perfect society would be. Whether or not like they actually did that for every episode and every series in the future, that's the core idea. The core idea of Babylon 5 is that this is an imperfect society. We're going to have human main characters getting addicted to drugs, getting gambling, getting arrested, doing things that main characters in Star Trek usually they had to use other alien species to explore that side of things.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's worth noting, we're even seeing that in this scene, and later we'll come back to the ISN reporter, where she is literally telling us, hey, your main characters that are like the heroes of this show on Star Trek, right? Picard is a stellar person. Even his backstory, right? His flawed backstory is he got stabbed in the heart and he's just so awesome. That's why he's there. We'll find out that Sinclair, who is the captain of the station, commander of the station, I guess, and Garibaldi have weaknesses, which is actually what makes them awesome.
Yeah. So a couple more things about this scene. Interesting. It looked like they were trying to set up Garibaldi as a womanizer. Like immediately, like he picks up this, I don't know what's going on, this root from a cabbage head alien who...
It looked like a ginger root, honestly, isn't that bad. Yeah.
But it's like an alien. He kept talking about it as an aphrodisiac, if you use the powers right to her. And then after she leaves off in disgust, he goes back to cabbage head, actually pays for the root and says, this better not leave a waxy buildup. What is going on in this scene?
It's funny, the womanizing character, and he does, it's worth noting, Jerry Doyle is the actor who plays Michael Garibaldi, looks like a knockoff Bruce Willis, which is not even a joke. Like
half Bruce Willis and half Seth MacFarlane from the front, but in the back, Dan Aykroyd all the way. You look at anything of the back, he looks like Dan Aykroyd.
For season one, and he does lose his hair later, which becomes a joke. And yeah, season one, he is definitely kind of a womanizer, but is pretty tame in 90s parlance. There's a character who doesn't show up in this episode, Talia Winters, psychic. They actually get married in real life and divorced in real life.
Divorced very soon after.
But he regularly hits on her. That he is going to have an episode, I think, in season two where he hooks up with someone. So yeah, he is set up kind of as a womanizer in the early episodes. But it's kind of funny where I think you're right. This is one of those... Early on, you're trying to give characters attributes and you see what sticks. And I don't think that really stuck around. Now, speaking of a character trait that does stick around, scene two, this character's really consistent. This scene shocked me because we meet Dr. Stephen Franklin in MedLab, who was recently introduced. So played by Franklin Biggs, a fantastic actor. He actually has a huge soap opera background. I think he was on, I'm forgetting which one, like All My Children, one of those big name ones, hundreds of episodes. And this show in some ways is cursed, where many of the people from the show are dead, including Richard Biggs, who died in 2004, was only 44, but just a phenomenal. It was Days of Our Lives, by the way, 384 episodes of Days of Our Lives. But Dr. Franklin in MedLab, where he's doing some RNA, and then randomly his friend Vance steps in. So he's like, oh, my old friend Vance.
My mom went nuts when she saw him. She was visiting last week and I was rewatching this episode and she kept saying, man from Uncle, man from Uncle.
So this, when we talked about Patricia Healy is kind of like a bit actress who's had some parts, but, you know, isn't around anymore, which is kind of a bummer. When we're talking David McCallum, who is the actor who plays Vance, the alien smuggler, which we'll find out. And by alien smuggler, I mean, he's smuggling alien technologies. He is, in fact, human. He also did the voice of Alfred in many adaptations of Batman and an actor with just a huge resume, as you're saying.
Oh, so, I don't know. Which adaptations of Batman did he do that?
More recently. Yeah. So, I mean, I was just looking up, but yeah, he played Alfred in several, and I'd be curious if we could talk to you. Maybe Jeff, for those that don't know, Jeff does. Tom and Jeff watch Batman and has watched many iterations of Batman. I'll have to ask if he's seen any of the ones that David McCallum did the voice of Alfred in. And sadly, David McCallum passed 2023. But he shows up and he's like, Steven, my friend, I've got an opportunity of a lifetime for you.
Yeah, he's very cagey about it. He just says, would you like an adventure? Which is not exactly what he's doing.
But if we're setting up, as we're noting, the kind of these first couple of episodes that feed you one thing while secretly giving you world building, we still are very much on the monster of the week. We haven't revealed our monster yet. But so many of these initial episodes start with a random person coming onto the station. And I don't know how to say this politely, but like they have resting villain face. So you have
you can spot the villain immediately.
Yeah, so Vance shows up. He's like, Steven, I have an adventure for you. You're like, you're villain. He's a bad guy. Steven, he's a bad guy.
Pay no attention to my downturned British.
And sorry to jump ahead because we're not going to cover this episode, but the episode with the Nazi person with the eye scar that comes on.
Yeah, we'll talk about that at some point.
At some point, but season one has so many episodes that start with this formula. Start with the station, random's going on, which is awesome. That's good world building. JMS feeds you stuff, in some cases subtly, in other cases bashes you over the head with it. Miss Piggy yelling, Babylon 4 is important. So like, let's see, can I do this? Let's see, Babylon. I don't have a Miss Piggy. Babylon.
Piggy, not again.
Babylon 5 with Muppets.
Mike. Oh, geez. Why did I let her out of the cage again?
And the show, we couldn't finish recording the show because Dre just laughed for 30 minutes and then we both had to leave. Okay, so in some cases, a character screaming exposition at you. In other cases, just random going on, which is good. A person shows up on the station and you point and you're like, a villain. Clearly the villain. And then somehow that turns into a monster of the week somehow. Yep. And this one is probably one of the more clever.
So are we going on to the smugglers part next? Because that scene is very vague. Like usually they spend a lot more time on the initial person, but like he just comes in and says, I'm your old teacher. We're in for an adventure.
And then we immediately cut. And Mike, we cut to at least on this show, at least on the You Gotta Check This Out show, the introduction of what's going to take at least a little bit of time to explain, the Sucker Punch. You introduced this in our notes. I was so excited because we have Nelson Drake is played by actor Marshall Teague, another resting villain. So this is a guy, he's coming into customs at Babylon 5, and he's saying, here are these artifacts I have to declare. He's this tall guy in real life. Marshall Teague is a Marine. Don't want to look into his politics because he goes on to act in Reagan. Another thing is he is a recurring actor on Babylon 5. Babylon 5, because it was an alien show, you would have actors that could be a human in one episode. You slap some makeup on them, they're a Narn, like a lizard one, another episode. You put a bone thing around their head, they're a Mimbari. So he is one of these actors. He's going to show up a lot in the show. Nelson Drake has some great roles coming up, but in this episode, he is the clear villain henchman. Spoiler, soon to become the clear villain. He's smuggling stuff into the station. But guess what, Mike? The brand new guy at Babylon 5, the brand new customs agent, he knows what's up. He's like, hey, these boxes you're bringing in, they don't line up. I think you're smuggling something in. And then Nelson Drake, do we count this as a sucker punch?
Oh, this is the very first sucker punch that I think that I've... Oh, no, for this episode, the first sucker punch of the episode.
Well, as it's... And let's explain sucker punch, and then we can actually argue how much this counts as one.
Well, it's a sucker punch is something that is used in Babylon 5 early on to force a plot point to move forward really quick. It's a punch that comes out of nowhere. One person in the episode decides that they need to escalate things really quickly and in kind of an unforeseen way. And it happened quite a lot.
And I think the key point is you're saying it's one person decides to throw a punch and the other person does not know what's coming, because we're going to have some sucker punches that sadly don't get to be sucker punches because the other person is aware they're coming.
They see it coming. Usually, if it's in the middle of a fight, it could be a sucker punch if it's a new unexpected way. There's a nice stick move that happens later on in the series. But yeah, usually it's like you're just in a scene where not much is going on. Two people are talking. All of a sudden, a sucker punch happens out of nowhere. And I was watching the first season and I slowly noticed that this happens many, many times in the first like 10 to 12 episodes as an inciting incident.
Now, brief tangent, we have both done some supplemental reading for the series. The book Becoming Superman by J. Michael Straczynski, fantastic read. Check it out if you have not. It's wild. And he even does talk Babylon 5 and stuff in there.
Yeah. I think a future episode, we're going to deal well more with JMS's background and go into the book.
I am so looking forward to that. And he did a book on writing, which I have never read, but I think you were. But the key to Sucker Punch, which is funny, is there are tropes and things that JMS himself and like director's commentaries reveals. He talks about these exposition dumps where he goes, it's annoying to have a character do an exposition jump in a show, but if you have a 5-hour television show and you're still trying to do week to week, you got to go with the mantra right from comics. Every comic could be someone's first comic.
Yeah. So each episode has to have an arc into it, even if it's only trying to set something up for something later.
And there's, of course, the previously on Lost, which is the most hilarious method, which is you come into an episode and before the episode, they're like, previously on Lost, this person you haven't seen in 3 seasons, talking to this person you haven't seen in 2 seasons. And this thing that just happened, you're like, I think I know where you're going. Whereas JMS, despite being very verbose, is more subtle, right? He's, I'm going to feed you the information you need to hear for this episode. It might seem odd that this person is saying it loudly like the reporter. In this case, it worked well. I think you and I both agree. The reporter actually is a fantastic way to deliver this. But then also another writing trick when we're talking Sucker Punch is this scene should take about 30 minutes, right? It should be, oh, your bags don't look right. Oh, I think these are smuggling. I'm going to talk to these. Hey, man, you don't need to do that. It goes on and on. And you're like, okay, we've got the important part out of the way. We want to get on to the next scene. How do we escalate it? And you're right. Funniest thing is the quickest way to get out of a scene is to have one guy punch the other person.
Throw the punch and have it go on. Yeah. And this happens so much in the first 10 episodes. Yeah. So in this case, do you want to go into the scene itself?
I was going to ask, do you count as a punch? Because he does a headlock and it's one of the weirdest looking. I'm like, is that doing anything? He headlocks the guy and he has what looks like a taser, but it turns out we'll discover is like almost an inverted defibrillator, which can fake a cardiac arrest on someone. So he stabs this guy in the back with this little taser looking thing that's almost undetectable, almost, unless there's a crack doctor, spoiler the future in the show. And he kills the customs guy and runs off with the alien artifacts. And this is the adventure that Vance had been promising.
One other thing that happens a lot in these episodes is smuggling. That kept coming back to me. Obviously, we're in a space station where there's going to be a customs department and there's going to be a lot of goods coming in from all the different species. But JMS's two original ideas for the series, one was a smugglers out in space who are just constantly smuggling things through a customs depot. And his other idea was more of the straightforward, like, space opera where it's going to happen for a bunch of seasons, but it wasn't going to be centered on any kind of a space station. It was just going to be, oh, these aliens are all on these planets. And the inception of Babylon 5, which really took place in him, he said, was when he put those two ideas together, where let's take the smuggling plots that he already had and take that as a location, but then pull in the space opera and have it take place in the one location. So I think what happened because of that was he was kind of building in his mind all of these smuggling plots, and almost every episode of the first season has a smuggler type B plot where they go to somebody smuggling in through customs or there's some type of inspection scene. And in this one, it is definitely one of the main inciting incidents and kind of the whole plot to the episode.
And what I actually love about that as a universe, so the sci-fi element of lived in. So Babylon 5 is a lived in universe. That's what many have said made the original Star Wars movies like so great, is the universe feels lived in. Star Trek tries to feel like a utopia. We have teleporters. We have things that can replicate whatever you want. We have a room that can generate whatever you want. Babylon 5 doesn't show up in this episode, but a recurring theme is one of the captains second in command, Takahashi, I want to say, in the pilot episode, she doesn't come back. And then Ivanova, they smuggle in coffee and they have a hydroponic station to feed the station. And then they, like various people, it's like you're not supposed to use it for personal use, but certain people will smuggle in coffee. And like coffee is a luxury item. So this kind of stuff, right? It makes a lot of sense. If you're on a box in the middle of space, smuggling becomes a huge thing. And this makes the universe more real to say, hey, people coming here might be trying to get stuff to the wrong spot. I mean, we have wars going on. So getting people weapons, that comes up all of the time. And then we wind up, the next scene is just kind of funny. I'm really curious what you thought here. It felt so soap opera-y. So almost following up what we just happened, the custom guy dies. So we have Garibaldi, chief of security. We have Dr. Franklin there for the autopsy and Captain Sinclair. Hey, there was just a murder on a station, all talking. And they're almost at odds with each other because Garibaldi's like, this is fishy. And Franklin's, I think it was just a heart attack. And Garibaldi's going, what? There's no way he had a heart attack. And Franklin goes, do you think I'm a doctor?
You see all of their wants kind of bouncing off of each other in the scene where it's really just exposition because what the scene has to get to is, all right, why is Vance there? What does he want? What is the history of these things that he's smuggling in? And it's made a lot more interesting by just what you said. We know that Franklin is indebted to his old professor and is going to give him more than his fair share of rope that he should give, which is going to allow him to kind of get further on with his plot than he would have if it were just any doctor on the ship. Anybody would have come in and seen him and, no, what are you doing with those artifacts? Those are contraband. Get rid of those. I think he's playing off of Franklin's sympathy very well in these scenes.
Well, what's interesting, and I may talk more about this in a future scene about like characterization, is what I could also buy is Franklin might be going, hey, I want to go focus on this thing with Vance. I don't want to be doing my job right now. And that's going to happen in a bit. So it was an interesting scene, just ups the stakes a little. And then we actually do cut back to Med Lab where Vance with Nelson Drake, murderer Nelson Drake for Sucker Punch, bring in these alien artifacts. And I actually will say we do get some more world building going where what we get is these alien artifacts are organic technology. And it's something mm-hmm. that Earth can't crack. And that is going to be huge throughout the entirety of this show. We know that the Vorlons, I think it's been mentioned, if it's not mentioned in this episode, the Vorlons are an alien race. The mysterious ones, they have organic technology. They're one of the more powerful races on this show.
The Minbari, right? Since the Vorlons and the Minbari already have this technology and Earth is trying to get a hold of it.
We don't know if Minbari actually do have organic. What Minbari have that's different. So interesting thing about Babylon 5 we didn't mention is it's a space station. It's spinning. Its artificial gravity is from that. The Minbari, their spaceships do not have spinning. They have like artificial gravity somehow that Earth doesn't have. And that's when we're talking about this versus Star Trek is in this universe, Earth is not the top of the pecking order. They're important, but they're not the most important or strongest race. And then there are other races that have things we do not. And then actually, as we're noting, when you're talking about smuggling, et cetera, is a regular thing that will come up. Earth trying to get technology that we do not have access to in this universe. So Vance shows Dr. Franklin the organic technology. And this was a back and forth you and I had in a lot of our notes was, is it bad acting or is the character a bad actor? Which I know is weird to say, but is a subtle distinction. Meaning, in this first season of Babylon 5, I do think some of these people are finding their character, are learning how to act, are learning how to get the character. And all of the feels in the world, if you are on a sci-fi show, it has got to be so much harder to get to the cadence because you have to first off get like what the vibe of the show is, right? Do you need to overact? I think he's not in this episode at all, which is a bummer. But Jakar, played by Andreas Katsoulis, the one-armed man in The Fugitive, fantastic actor. He realizes pretty soon on, he's, oh, I am an opera character in this.
And well, him and Londo are both like playing that to the hilt.
Yes, they're at 11, but it's perfect. But people mm-hmm. fighting themselves, of course, you're acting against green screens. You're acting against people in makeup. You don't know how things are going to look when they're done.
Well, we just notice as well, like that there's a lot of soap opera actors too coming and going on this. So it's like all of these people, not only are the main actors kind of figuring out their characters and figuring out what they have to do, as well as having to play these hints of what's to come that are going to be subtle and can't be spoken out in full words at the beginning of these episodes. So I think a lot of that was also kind of cooking in under the surface for why it came off as not the best acting at first, but it always knows that, like, we knew that, all right, we know what's to come, we'll stay with it.
But in this case, for instance, Vance is being the worst actor in the world lying about these artifacts, but I think it plays because Steven is so interested. Dr. Franklin is so interested in them, he's not paying attention. So the rest of us are like, he is clearly evil. That is an evil man right there. Do you see this evil man? And yeah. Dr. Franklin, his eyes are already at the microscope. He's not paying attention.
Well, it's not just the science that he's really into. It's that this is his idol. This is his mentor. This is like his first teacher that brought him into science. So he's just overlooking all these smaller things as he's doing the research.
So we got the alien technology. They're working on it together. Nelson Drake, the dumb henchman, as he's putting the boxes away, Steven and Vance walk off. There's a box. Raiders of the Lost Ark, man, don't open the box, but he opens the box. Did you count this as a sucker punch?
No, because this is just, he just looks into it and the lightning kind of goes into his face really quick. I don't count it as a sucker punch because that would mean that the artifact self was trying to sucker punch him and they were looking right each other at the eyes when that happened.
Well, the artifact is sentient, which is what we're going to discover, but I will give it to you. Okay, he was looking right at it. It's not a surprise. Like it starts glowing. It's like he could have shut the lid, but yeah, Nelson Drake, this big marine guy opens this box. gets flung across the room by this electricity. So wild that people in the command and control center up at the front of the station are, whoa, what was that? Again, this is building organic scary technology that can graft onto humans. Will that come up later? Spoiler alert, yes.
It comes and up right away.
Then we do cut to the command deck where Sinclair, Ivanova, and Garibaldi are all kind of like talking about the day. This is actually a fun point to bring up. Like, what is the meaning of a day in space? I don't think we've talked about Ivanova much, but she's the second in command on the station. She is a Russian Jew who is really an avatar for J. Michael Straczynski, a Russian Jew, but she doesn't do much this episode, but they're kind of like...
Yeah, we'll bring her for that later episode. Yeah, she doesn't really do much at all this episode.
But we do briefly get like some, not really needed, but Sinclair, the commander of the ship, says, I don't want to give this interview because I gave an interview in the past, spoke my mind, and got shipped somewhere else. So we get some character building this episode, which really is to tell us that two of the highest ranking people on the station, Commander Sinclair and Michael Garibaldi, they're not awesome. This is not Picard and Riker, the best and the brightest that Starfleet has to offer. These are two people, and like, why are they, you might be asking yourself, why are they here? And again, this is good world building because we're going to find
both
out
both of them,
it.
Like it said in the episode, have lost positions or have been bounced around, especially Sinclair. This is like his final straw, he thinks, because he's lost five other positions before on Earth Force.
Yeah, and this is it. And I mean, it's funny where this actually did show up in like the pilot, but he's got major PTSD in a future episode. They're yelling like, what happened? You were on this great trajectory. And then what happened? It's like, this is not a spoiler. You know this from the pilot. And it kind of comes up, but Commander Sinclair was involved in this giant battle that was the last battle of the huge war, which is mentioned in the intro for the show. And he was dying. He was about to die. And then he blacked out and lost a day. And that's a recurring thing that's going to show up in the season. And he doesn't know what happened. And after that happened, he kind of goes on this downhill slide. So it's hilarious. They're like, you were on this amazing trajectory. What happened? He's like, oh, I was in the worst war in human history and got PTSD and never recovered. That's kind of explained.
Yeah, and they don't pick that up till about halfway through the season. But it's really that becomes the main thrust of his character arc, even after he's, spoiler alert, off the show for a while.
And I don't think that's a huge spoiler in saying, if you're watching this, if you grab the DVD from the library, you're watching on streaming, you're not going to see Commander Sinclair's face, right? You're going to see Tron. Bruce Boxleitner is going to be the prominent one. Michael O'Hare, who is a prominent actor in season one, leaves after season one, and that's going to we're going to speak a ton to that in future, to what JMS is able to do. All right, we're gonna get going fast into second here. We're getting the next three scenes go really quick, which I love. So I'm going to call this like world building and character arcing, which I hadn't realized, which is we're back at the lab. Steven and Vance are still doing all sorts of experiments on this organic technology. Vance is like, Steven, you got to go to sleep. Dr. Franklin is like wide awake. And you're like, oh, this.
Yeah, everyone else is falling asleep. Something's going on with Franklin. We have seen him up and doing this the entire episode.
We're like, are you getting a little extra help there? Is that okay?
And yeah, what's going on, Franklin? What are you getting? What's going on under the table there?
Yeah, I'll just say, keep an eye on if Dr. Franklin maybe he's getting a little extra help and if that's going to hurt him. And another bit of world building we get is Dr. Franklin starts asking Vance about this, and he basically says Interplanetary Exposition funded this research. And you were saying smugglers like a common thing. Another thing that's going to come up regularly, and we're starting to get the seeds planted for it here, is the shadow organizations that pay for expeditions to alien worlds to look for technology.
Yeah, and if they were paid to go look for these things somewhere, somebody knew about them or had a hunch of where they could get them and paid for them.
And we're going to find that is going to be a recurring bit to let people know that these... Like in this one, where they're just called like interplanetary expeditions. And we're going to find out more about them later. We get a little more exposition dump. And this is what I was telling you. Garibaldi still trying to keep the ISN reporter off of Sinclair. Like I said, when you have to exposition dump, having a new character come in, Ernie Hudson and Ghostbusters kind of thing. So this reporter coming in, having her get fed up and yelling at you exposition, or having... In this case, what's really
cool.
Is
this the scene where she jumps onto CNC, where she jumps on the main command bridge?
No, that's later. But what's happening is she's still trying to get a hold of Sinclair. Garibaldi's like, he's not around. And she's going, hey, I did some digging on you too, Garibaldi. And you've been knocked around stations. Like, this is probably your last chance to, again, giving us the character backstory on both Sinclair and Garibaldi this episode, that, hey, they're the people in charge, but they're not like respected people that are in full command of the job. And after that, then what we get is Nelson Drake, who has been looking terrible. He was like walking around with a, I would use a,
it's like silly putty with some metallic glitter on top of it is what they use for his skin. But it's into his skin.
I called it grayscale from Game of Thrones. But yeah, same thing.
Oh, you're much more eloquent than me. I just called it silly putty with glitter.
Well, that's what it was used. I mean, you're right. It's like we got modern day special effects, but he's walking around and then he turns into this giant alien monster.
Have you seen the Star Trek episode from season one where Talia gets killed by the mud monster?
Of course, everybody's seen that episode.
That's,
of course.
This guy, what he turns into completely reminded me of that mud monster, even though it's like more of a techno alien thing. It just starts covering him in this black stuff. And that's all I could think of.
And then I don't know what to describe. He's like kind of silvery, kind of looks like the Silver Samurai from X-Men, but he turns into a monster.
Yeah.
He attacks Franklin. Franklin winds up in the infirmary. And like now everything's coming to a head, right? Where he's got to reveal, hey, he left these things on the station. Hey, it was his friend. Everything's okay. They start revealing that every time the alien has used an electrical burst from this technology, that it's been getting stronger and stronger. The weapons they have aren't enough to take it out without breaching the hull. We're going to have Sinclair, Garibaldi, security try and go after him. Yep. And then I called this Deus Ex Doctor, because Dr. Franklin Advance start using their science to look at the technology. Is there anything they can learn about the technology? And I was going to say, I can give the explanation to you.
Oh, well, I'll try.
It's really clever.
I thought so too. I'll try and we'll see if you can fill in the holes too. So what they find out is that the technology was Ikara 7 was the name of the civilization. And they were getting attacked many times and just wiped out by these other aliens. Another thing that could come back in the future, because we don't know who is attacking them. But they built up these weapons with these alien artifacts, the organic material. But because they only wanted their people to use it, it is coded into their DNA. So that only the pure Akarians could be the ones could wield these weapons against the attackers.
Oh, 100%. Essentially, it's what if you had, I know this is really hard for people in modern era to view, what if you had the most advanced technology being wielded by racist religious zealots? I know that's really hard for people listening to this. If we're recording this in 2025, if you want to date it. So I know it's a really weird thing to throw out there. So that happens, and so they make this super strong armor weapon that can take out the defenders, but when it's done, it turns on its own people, and it destroys them all. And they're able to read the memory, because it's encoded. There's memory encoded in the technology.
Because it's organic technology, yeah.
So they're able to read it, and this is where it gets actually super fascinating to end the episode, because they give that information to Commander Sinclair. So security's getting beat down by this monster. Everything's going wrong. People are worried on the station. You brought out Miss Piggy attempts to come onto the command and control deck and go,
what's
happening? Well, even
before that scene happens on the way, it's like there is almost a West Wing style walk and talk of them talking about how this is parallels to Nazis and Aryan Brotherhood. It's so weird that this came up in Youngblood as well, because there is those same themes of the Nazi experiments to make the perfect human. And that's kind of what this is going for too. The Ikari made this perfect killing machine, but it had to only go, it could only be used by quote unquote pure Ikari.
And one of the background things, and I don't know if they reveal it too much in this episode, but it is part of his background story that we've heard, is Commander Sinclair was raised by Jesuit priests. So he's got he's supposed to be a philosopher. That's supposed to be part of his character, which may be important, maybe not. And yeah, really JMS does lean a lot on World War II
authoritarianism,
fascism, Nazi stuff a lot for Babylon 5. And it makes me sad because I was like, watch it in the 90s, wow, this is amazing. And then you watch it in the 2020s, and you're like,
there's a lot of reasons why we're doing this series right now. And there are so many parallels to what's going on in the world and U.S. politics.
Yeah, so they've got that walk and talk going on, as you're noting. Sinclair is going to be able to use it. Miss Piggy comes onto the bridge and is, what's going on? And then, like, this one's funny is Ivanova is one of my favorite characters. And early episodes, you and I in our notes had to note that she was really trying to lean into the Russian, almost the too harsh in terms of like that, and even a little bit of the accent.
And she was doing the accent without doing the accent in her mannerisms, too, even. It's like very stiff.
It just didn't quite work, but she finds herself. Claudia Christian finds herself amazing Ivanova, one of my favorite characters in a sci-fi thing. It's funny to see her in season one as she's finding herself. This is one of the first scenes where I thought, oh, that's Ivanova, because the reporter tries to come onto the deck and Ivanova's like,
the reporter, Miss Piggy makes it on the deck, which how the hell did that happen? I mean, this goes right back to what we were talking to before about Garibaldi not being the best in charge of security if random reporters can just get to the main command of the entire Babylon 5 station.
But I've noticed that's just like a sci-fi trope. It happens on Star Trek. I know you're a little bit ahead, and this isn't really a major spoiler, but in season two, the inaugural episode of season two of Babylon 5, first episode, again, we do actually have resting villain. We go back to that a little in season two, the first episode, comes onto the ship, walks up to a computer and is like, computer, tell me where the most important people are. And the computer's like, to get to the most important people, go here. And you're like, what? No, but you know, the plot's got a plot. So that happens. She makes it onto the deck and Ivanova says, get off the deck. And she says something, you're too young for that kind of pain or something, which is awesome. I was like, heck yeah, Ivanova. And then now we get our major monster of the week fight. But what I loved about this, and this is very Star Trek-y, but still fun, is it is a philosophical fight.
Immediately, like Sinclair takes everything he's learned about the history of the artifacts and the Ikari, and immediately use that to say, you're only going for purity. Who you're trying to, like, the monster of the week, the alien Nelson guy, keeps saying protect as he's shooting everybody on the ship. And Sinclair brings up to him that, who are you trying to still protect? Because there's nobody left of Ikari.
And actually kind of clever, because he's organic. This is a symbiote, like Venom, basically, right? This alien technology that's organic has merged with Nelson Drake, taken him over.
Have you ever seen Superman 3?
Oh, Superman 3.
You remember Superman? This is what I kept thinking at this part, because this is when Nelson's gone for the full transformation. Superman 3, there's the one scene where the henchwoman gets thrown back into a computer and all kinds of, they use this stop motion effect to have wires go into her and kind of transform her into a cyborg. I mean, it's completely nightmare fuel. And it has stayed with me my entire life. It scared the shit out of me as a kid. And it was exactly look like what this guy turns into.
That is wild, because Superman 3, I remember, you know,
Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor skiing off a building at some point.
It's that one.
And then, of course, they use the plot. It is later used in Office Space, the money laundering scheme they wind up using.
Yeah, the rounding off. It's the same exact scene. But yeah, go watch that scene or look up that. I'll put in on the accompanying article on MikeSlater.com for the episode, which we haven't mentioned yet, but I'll get some pictures of this too so everybody can see what we're talking about.
I absolutely love it. So yeah, you've got this alien artifact that has infused its memory into this human, Nelson Drake. And then Sinclair says, hey, look at this guy's memory. He's been to your world. It's gone. And then the end, he like the alien just leans up and is like, Ikari, it says something like that. And it's, yeah, Sinclair won with his mind because he's wicked smart.
Yeah, and he went off to a part of the ship where they could blow it up if they had to. And Sinclair had those orders, be ready to blow up the ship with me on it. I'll keep him on there. He just was immediately not just ready to, but wanted to sacrifice himself for this.
And that is really going to come up later. So we get two wrap-ups. We get two wrap-up scenes coming up.
Take us away, Dre.
So what happens is Dr. Franklin talks to Vance and he finds the taser and he's, hey, you know, this taser could have been used to fake a heart attack. And he goes, I think I know, Vance. He's like, I know you knew what you were doing. And Vance kind of then comes out and says, IPX is really a front for a weapons organization and this find is worth millions and come with them. And Dr. Franklin's like, absolutely not, gets him arrested. And then this is definitely world building, a thing that we're going to see a lot and I absolutely love, which is he's take that bad guy away, the heroes win. Right after, EarthGov comes in and says, hey, we're taking those artifacts for EarthGov research. And that is a recurring thing that comes up is our heroes on Babylon 5 stop something nefarious. And when it's all done, they're like, all right, all wrapped up. Bad guys in handcuffs, evil stuff. Let's get rid of it. And EarthGov comes in as, hey, we got to have that. So I was actually amazed in hindsight rewatching the show, like how early this happens to get that hint that, hey, EarthGov, as you're noting, ISN gives us some feedback into Earth sentiment for Babylon 5. And the government itself was popping in and going, that evil technology that almost took out your station, we're going to need that for reasons.
Yeah, then that keeps coming up because they have been wanting that for the arms race they have out there. That's technology that Earth hasn't had. That seed was planted, but it wasn't brought back at the end, too. They only briefly mentioned it earlier in the episode, which is something that JMS does really well in a lot of these. Like, he plants these seeds. I had to watch this episode a couple times before it really sank in that whole ending. It was clear that they're taking the artifacts for everything, but it wasn't it. I had to come back and put, oh, wait, there is also an arms war going out specifically for this technology that could have big implications for the interplanetary conflicts that we're seeing.
What I really got to give a shout out to him, because the overarching theme we had for this episode was twofold: Monster of the Week versus world building, and kind of how JMS juggles that in early episodes. How he uses things like sucker punches in these early episodes, Monsters of the Week, these conventional TV tropes to feed people something palatable they're used to, while still amazingly doing a lot of world building. And as we're noting, doing it really well, because I remember this show and I was like, oh yeah, it takes till season two to get going before we find these things. And when I'm watching these episodes, like, oh yeah, like first major scene with Dr. Franklin, he's already planting this. Oh yeah, interplanetary expeditions or whatever they're called, because there's like other names that they're used for other things, they are important in the story. I'm like, oh yeah, he's planting that here. And in some of the interviews I was listening to him, he actually said in regards to world building, he almost has the anti-mystery box. For those that don't know, J.J. Abrams, famous showrunner on, for instance, the show Lost, has brought up this concept of the mystery box. And it's kind of been pitched as, people love mystery, so as long as you keep mystery, like, that keeps people interested. And then the argument is people get upset if they feel that you're just making stuff up. JMS has basically said, people will wait as long as you pay stuff off. So he is more than fine in his shows to say, I'm going to plant the seed of something, and you might need to wait two or three seasons before that pays off. But if you're paying attention and you're invested, it's going to be worth it. And as a fan, that makes you feel awesome. Because if you were watching this episode the first time through, and you're just like, that was really weird how EarthGov took that organic technology. What does that matter at all in the future? I'm going to tell you right now, if you clock out this episode, yes, it does.
It does. And there's so much of that in this series. That's what I've been like, because I remember going through Lost and being disappointed by the end, still enjoying as it went. But the big letdown was that it felt like they were building up to something and telling a story. And turns out that they really weren't. And even interviews with the creators later on said, yeah, we were just making up as we went along, because that's how you have to do it for episodic TV. But clearly, JMS had done it successfully with Babylon 5 years and years before.
Well, I'll give a defense of what I'll say Lost and How I Met Your Mother. So these are two shows that I say had a really good three-season arc. And the Lost creators even said that. They said they wanted to do like three. But then it's a monumentous hit. And the problem with the machine is you get this monumentous hit and they don't want you to stop. How I Met Your Mother, yeah. The premise is I'm going to meet your mother. Three seasons makes a lot of sense. Eight, nine, what's going on? The Barney Robin storyline makes sense, but they actually do it two times because they have to do it twice, if that makes any sense. So they're like, this is the storyline we would have done if this was a normal arc. And then, oh, we got to keep going. Let's do it again.
Yeah, the last season of that, where they had it all on kind of one day for the second half.
That was interesting. And by the way, what I'll throw out is there is a movie with Ryan Reynolds, Definitely Maybe, which is just the plot of How I Met Your Mother in movie format and done better because it's condensed. So Lost is the same way. Lost, if it had been a condensed storyline, which is what they wanted, could have been a good show. But when they're told you have to keep going, they're like, the infamous jump the shark moment for that show was the tattoo episode. And at that point, they're like, okay, there's only so much of
tattoos. What's going on with those?
They're like, no. They're like, okay, you got us. Wrap it up. I thought Lost was fine as a soap opera. If it was a Shortland Street-like show, that just kept going, but it needed to be one or the other, right? It needs to wrap up the mysteries, or just go on forever. You never resolve.
Well, what I thought it really did wrong was, and a lot of these shows get wrong, is that if you tell us what it's going to happen and it doesn't happen, it's like you're setting up a theme or a motif that's going to reoccur. And it's an expectation in the viewers that, hey, this is a show where there's going to be these mysteries that we're going to see. What's that polar bear doing? What's the smoke monster? And eventually it just becomes apparent that those promises are never going to be delivered. It's what, to me, separates like post-Endgame MCU from pre-Endgame MCU stuff, why it was loved for so long, because they told a very good story arc. They set everything up. And then after that Endgame, they started, well, how about this? Well, how about we do this? Well, how about we do this multiversal with Kang and everything too? And everything they put up either was like, oh, something happened where they couldn't continue it, or they just decided not to continue it. And the audience just kind of was too far steps ahead of them and got bored of it and left for the most part.
Yeah, there are a couple I like. I mean, the Marvel movies, there was a period of time that they were must-watch movies. If one was coming out, I was going to go see it. And then nowadays, it's very, like, I loved the Loki television show, and I have not had an inclination to watch the multiverse, whatever movie was based on it. Yeah, I don't even feel...
Probably the biggest Marvel fan I know. Marvel Cosmic is my jam, is my nerddom. MCU, I was so into. I've seen all of them in the theater, too. But yeah, there's a few that I'm probably not going to go back and rewatch since then, because they just were not great.
Anyway, so the other thing that happens is Garibaldi does go talk to Sinclair and basically say, hey, we're 4 episodes into this show, man. And just an FYI, you keep almost getting killed. Like, you went and fought Soul Hunter. You went and fought this guy. The previous episode of this is called Born to Purple. And that episode, Commander Sinclair goes undercover into a strip joint. True story. Yep. So it's like Garibaldi goes up and goes, hey, man, it feels like you're kind of just putting your life on the line and feeling aimless.
Are you on a suicide mission? Yeah, what's going on mentally?
What's going
here?
On there? Mm-hmm. So again, a lot of credit to this episode in that it really does a lot of both world building, planting seeds for things that now, having seen the whole show, am able to recognize. And this episode also building up our, really, you have to focus on Franklin, Garibaldi, Sinclair. So we miss some major players. Ivanov only gets a little bit of playing time. We don't see the major aliens. Londo and Jakar are musts, but it's an ensemble show. You can't give every character every episode, of course.
She gets to throw a Muppet off the bridge, so I will say she does get a very strong presence.
Babylon 5 with Muppets, I kind of want it now. So anyway, with that being said, really good episode. I thought it was really nice and palatable in showing the monster.
Well, we didn't really get to the last moment, though, too.
And the last moment we
do
have...
The last moment, it's with where they actually have the interview with Miss Piggy and Sinclair. And it's... I thought we talked about this a couple times. This is one of the episodes that JMS said he doesn't like. It's the one of... I don't know what the other one is, but he said there's 2 episodes where he hates from the first season. And this is one of them. Hates. Like, he would not... He can't believe he wrote that and cannot, like... gets writer's pain when he thinks like why he did this. And what he thought he did was he was just too obvious about it with the whole plot about purity, about racial purity. He was trying to force that in too much, and he sees like his writer's heavy hand on it. And this ending too kind of plays into that, because there's only a couple times in the season where I felt like, yeah, you're getting a little too high flutant for your own good to like really sell the ending. And this is, he did this again with this, the last speech he had. Man will be going to the star. We need to go on forever. Why we need to explore in this place so that, and he starts reciting like what Marilyn Monroe, Gandhi, and all these great humans that will live on. Like,
yeah, the final episode together. Is the reporter says, hey, after all the stuff that's happened, right? The first 4 Babylon stations were destroyed or vanished. Mm. And this one was almost destroyed today. Is it still worth it? And he's, of course it's worth it, because we have to go to the stars. And then it almost ends with like, da-na-na, which is a bummer, because the previous scene, which like I almost tried to end on, right, was we end with our heroes have vanquished this big foe, hero moment, and then EarthGov comes in and confiscates stuff, and oh, this is a lived-in universe, right?
Yeah.
And oh, what's going to happen next? That's Babylon 5. That's what we love. And then you have this stinger that really is a Star Trek. Like, you can almost see Picard going, Captain's log, we have to go to the stars, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, when Garibaldi comes up to Sinclair and is confronting him about the whole, hey, you're trying to be a hero. What you're trying to compensate for something. it struck me as we don't get that in many hero stories. How many stories do we see? How many movies do we see? Take all the superhero stuff. Where do they truly have a scene at the end where they say, maybe I'm doing this all for the wrong reasons? It's very rare, I think, in Western stories to question the hero after the arc like that.
For those that aren't aware, if you go to patreon.com/Jeff May for various shows, I'm hoping someday this show too, Mike, you can be a producer. And on the show I do with Jeff May, Nerd with Dre and Jeff, one of our producers is drinkwithmikeslater.com every time Dre pugs a back catalog. So you just asked about a good modern story tale where the hero has to deal with that. And fantastic movie, Iron Man 3, which Jeff and I did an episode of Nerd on. And that is like part of why that episode is great, right? If that movie is great, is Iron Man should be dealing with PTSD from everything he's dealt with. And he is in that movie. And that movie is about him struggling with all he's been through. And it humanizes him. And it's great. And you're like, wow, a great character study. Something worthy of J. Michael Straczynski, also a fantastic writer for Marvel properties. And then, of course, two or three things later, just, hey, I'm Iron Man. Quippy joke. Because got to sell that merch.
Yep. Yeah, you can get a lot of MCU content on MikeSlater.com, too. I have my full ranking of all of them by tiers, so...
Although it's noted, some of them are ranked oddly just because you haven't seen them yet. I made that mistake. I was like, really? It's that low? And you're like, oh, it's just, it's not ranked yet.
Yeah, there's a bottom tier for not watched by Mike tier.
And random, just a tangent shout out. Gamefully Unemployed has, I forget what it's called, but they're on episode 2 of rewatching Marvel movies. And they just did a fun one on The Incredible Hulk. So patreon.com/ Gamefully Unemployed.
Those are good.
Fun episode on The Incredible Hulk, the Edward Norton one, right? Which I dug. It was good.
I can't go too far into Marvel stuff. It was one of my least favorite Marvel movies for a long time, but I've come back to enjoy parts of it a lot more, especially like as MCU has added a few more clunkers to the list. It holds up better than I originally thought.
That's a bummer.
Plus, they just made a sequel to it in the fourth Captain America movie.
Interesting. I haven't seen that one yet with the Red Hulk.
President Red Hulk
with Harrison Ford, infamous interview now where he's just, that's what the money's for. Like Don Draper's it. I love it.
Oh, that movie is so trashy. It's like the first one that could classify as a good, bad movie from Marvel.
Oh, that's a bummer. I haven't seen it yet. My son is scared of Red Hulk, so I don't want to see it in theaters.
He should be. Red Hulk is very scary. He's also
so
the president.
He doesn't want to see, we've seen other movies in theaters. He doesn't want to see that. And I was going to wait till it came out and maybe I'll just watch something else. Okay. We got through the episode. I think the good thing about this one is there weren't major spoilers, major things in the future to kind of tack on the end. Mike, what are we, first off, this gets weird because it's like an unaired pilot. So either A, you're listening to this after you've heard the whole season and hopefully like it aged well. Hopefully like Babylon 5, you come back and go, oh, your first season, pretty good. You get better, but still holds up solid. That's my hope for this.
Yeah, so we may hold this on depending on how the next couple of recordings go. But yeah, you may be hearing this and saying, nope, you guys are totally wrong because you're in the future and we're not.
Yeah, you're in the future. Or I don't know, like depending, or if like in the future we air it in the correct order. So like Babylon 5 does not do this, but you know, the pilot would be the first thing you in theory could watch. It does not show up that way on Amazon. You have to go elsewhere. If you listen to this first in the future, so you didn't listen to it in the first run through, but you're watching it in syndication, the next episode is going to be episode 9, Deathwalker. And if all goes as planned, we'll have a special guest for that. That'll be the first premiere release, first on the air order. Or you got to check this out. Mike, anything to end up this already fantastic discussion of Babylon 5 and other nerdy things?
Yeah, check out MikeSlater.com. I should be adding supplementary material for all these episodes. I'm probably going to go in deep on all the sucker punches across season 1 in one article. And I'll probably have an accompanying article just with some pictures. Just, you know, you have something to look at about what we're talking about. And besides that, I mean, you can find me at SoundCloud under Slateron. You can find my band Mad Bread under SoundCloud as well. Go look up Mad Bread under YouTube. We got a lot of stuff if you're into folk and country. Besides, that's where you can find me. How about you, Dre?
Okay, I was going to say, most places, Nerd Numbers, Mike is a fantastic musician. Agreed with that. And I'm digging a music project that you in the future may have already seen the culmination of. I'm watching it in real time. It's fantastic. I'm excited to see the final output. You are also the composer of the amazing First Thought, Last Thought, Youngblood theme song, which if Youngblood does get an official television show, we need to pitch it. We need to go Liefeld. This is what you need. I mean, you mentioned Cable and Wolverine and Deadpool, so he probably won't, but...
So he'll be into it.
All right. Anyway, this has been You Gotta Check This Out. Hopefully you enjoyed checking this out. We are a huge fan of Babylon 5. Head over to patreon.com/Jeff May, which is at least at the time of the recording, the umbrella for this. You help out there. You help more stuff get made. As mentioned, MikeSlater.com, Slatron or Slatron 11, myself, Nerd Numbers, most places. Cannot wait to see the next thing You Gotta Check Out.